Hello, my name is Vimer Deese, and this is a Class War Battlefield podcast, addendum to the episode 2. In listening to the progression of the Trayvon Martin case, I have to say I am not surprised. A lot of other people are surprised. I'm not. They're shocked by the leaking of information to suggest that the kid was out of school for, you know, all kinds of things, and that he was overall a bad kid, or at least to suggest that he was in some way or another a bad kid. So, they are kind of saying, well, he kind of had it coming. If, you know, George Zimmerman didn't do it, then somebody would have, because this was a bad kid. You know, nor am I surprised that in stepping away, you know, the white sheriff was replaced by a black one in order to, you know, give the appearance that, look, we're not racist here. We have our own Negro. Look at our Negro. He's now leading us. And he's going to do a fair job because he's the same color as the kid. I'm not surprised by any of it. I'm not, because like I said, there's no justice for black people. Black people are problems in this nation. We don't deserve justice. We deserve something akin to it, but it's not justice. White folks deserve justice. Black people, well, we never understood true justice. We weren't smart enough to create a society where bigotry reigned, so we can't understand true justice, because justice is not for everybody. Now again, some of you may think that's cynical, but it's the reality. When you're black, it's the reality. You know from a very young age that there are certain ways that you can and you cannot act, that white people can act. That if you do certain things as black people, or either a black male or a black female, you're going to be seen as a threat, wherein if you see a white person do it, they're not a threat. It's something normal. It's something natural. It's come to the point where, as black people, we don't even try anymore to break those stereotypes, because it doesn't make any difference. I mean, granted, yeah, there are people out there trying to break those stereotypes. I'm one of them. But on the whole, the mass of us has given up. As it was said in the late 60s, we're tired of trying to prove to white people that we're not going to hurt them. 40 plus years later, 44 years ironically, if you know anything about numerology, you know, understand why I say ironically, we're now looking at a dead kid, almost to the day of Martin Luther King's death. A kid who, you know, after Troy Davis, you know, there was Troy Davis, which everyone was up in arms about, because he wasn't guilty, and yet his only crime was being black, and that's why he had to die. Then Trayvon Martin came along, and this might actually be the spark. I said this in my last one, in my last quick comment that I added into the episode 2. This might actually be the spark to awaken America, particularly black America and conscious white America. The only question is to where? Where are we going with it? Are we going to have a broader discussion about racism in this nation? Everyone wants to talk about this whole stand your ground thing, which I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But are we really going to have a conversation about how black people live in this nation and how we have been still relegated to fourth and fifth class people? Where justice is something that we dream about but we never actually attain? Where Martin Luther King is used as a benchmark for justice and yet nobody cares about what he actually said? Barack Obama's a prime example of this. He has a busk of Martin Luther King in the Oval Office, looking at him. Well, what has he done? Okay, so he has Martin Luther King, man. You might as well take a sledgehammer and just beat that thing down to pulp. Because it's not like when you look at it, Barack Obama, Mr. President, that you actually think, well, what would King do if he was in my position? Oftentimes when I get discouraged with Barack Obama, I think about something that was said in the fifth season of West Wing. After Jeb's daughter had been kidnapped and he was with Leo, and he was talking to Leo about the causes. You know, they had assassinated a state leader, and he deduced that it was probably because of that assassination that his daughter was taken. And he made a statement about that Martin Luther King said about violence spiraling into an endless spiral of violence. And Leo says, well, Dr. King was a smart man. He just didn't have your job. And here's the question that I often want to ask Mr. Barack Obama. When does it stop being a job and when does it start being a responsibility? Because it is a responsibility. As Dan Carlin points out in his, I think it's episode 222 for Common Sense, Barack Obama is not leading in normal times. This is a... Republicans like to speak about, you know, everything being important. You know, every election is the most important one in this generation. You know something? Shut up. This election, this time period, this next 5 to 10 years is going to completely make or break this republic. America will live or die according to what happens in this next 5 to 10 years. And Trayvon Martin, along with Occupy Wall Street, along with U.S. Uncut, along with all of these other micro movements, including the real green movement that is not going along with these institutionalized movements. And when I say institutionalized, I'm talking about these individuals who call themselves professional lefts, which I may get to. But, you know, I really want to get to what the Stand Your Ground law gets at. But with all these micro movements, this is what they're trying to do. It's like the beginning of the 70s or the end of the 60s, where you had all these splintered factions trying to coalesce into one group and move towards a final point, which is the creation of a stable society, a beloved community, a beloved society, a feminine society. We're nurturing, where we nurture people, where we elevate people, and we take care of them. People who think that is a wussy way to think, they're ignorant. They don't understand how societies have always worked. The greatest societies, the ones that have had the greatest longevity, has been ones that have been nurturing. You know, I've heard some discussion recently about our economic system. How was it said? I can't even remember how it was said, but it essentially our economic system. Oh, if our economic system did not exist how it existed, then we'd be living less, as it were. And I heard this discussion, and it completely blew my mind, because I'm like, how are you going to be living less if we're not always thinking about money, if we're not thinking about competition? How would you be living less? To kind of explain this concept, they said, well, you know, if you look back at ancient primitive people, which I considered the Native Americans primitive people because they were before the whole concept of capitalist accumulation. But if you look at them, you know, they did indeed have what we might call a lower standard of living because they didn't live like we lived. But, and the person pointed this out, they did do something that we don't do. They spent a lot of time getting along with each other. They spent a lot of time doing leisurely things. And they spend a lot of time nurturing. Now, I've always said that I don't believe if our economic system were to change, that we have to sacrifice our standard of living. But what we do have to do is select a standard of living and stick by it, and then build our society up around it. But I am way away from Trayvon Martin. Trayvon Martin, though, this is what I'm saying. And this is why, like, when Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson want to run to these things, and they want to get involved, and they want to, you know, help to lead their people again, this is why I'm like, you know something, get the hell away, because there's nothing that you're going to do that's actually going to help these people get to where they need to be at. When I look at things like Trayvon Martin, when I look at things like Troy Davis, I don't see what's going on currently as the stopping point. No, I see how it is interconnected, and I see how it aims and shoots towards that economic end, that community end, which we need to be living towards. Now, the whole stand your ground, and by the way, I guess I should say, that's a conscious vision. You know, sometime in the coming future, I will have to lay out for you the whole concept of vision points and viewpoints. Viewpoints are individual, and vision points are collective. You see from multiple people's, quote, viewpoints. You know, it's the empathetic version of assimilating into a group. You can see the entire edifice by standing in one spot and using everyone else's views to paint a picture. And then you can analyze it and, you know, create from that analysis either how you can get to that view or that vision, or how you got to that vision. But the whole stand your ground thing, those laws are so worrisome to me. And the reason why they're worrisome to me is because it proves that we are really degenerating as a community and as a society and as a nation. Those are barbarous. Barbarous. And you may say barbaric, but I like saying barbarous. Laws which speak back to a time when specifically out west was untamed, so to say. People were more apt to need protection where law enforcement couldn't get there in time. In other words, when lawlessness reigned. This is very, very troubling to me. Because if we allow individual citizens to do this, sooner or later, we're going to get back to a point where the lynch mob is approved. Where the lynch mob is approved. Don't forget, do not forget, the lynch mob. And by the way, people who often say, oh, well, white people will lynch too. You know, we have to remember that the whole concept of lynching came from this guy, Willie Lynch, who came up from the Caribbean to teach Americans how to break their Negro slaves, their black slaves, their nigger slaves, as it were, back then. So white people were not lynched. Black people were. White people were hung. Oh, yeah. But they weren't lynched. And when you really look at the trajectory of lynching and how it actually progressed, how, you know, it would start up and then how it would rage through, you know, white people didn't go through that. White people didn't have to worry about night raids. It's kind of like what the military does now when they're over in Iraq, the night raids. Every time when I hear about one of those, I think back to the Ku Klux Klan and how they would just kick in some person's door, take out their son or daughter, and lynch them. And lynch him. But sooner or later, like I said, the lynch mob is going to be approved again. And we need not forget that the reason why most of the lynch mobs happened were because the people felt threatened. In some way or somehow, they felt threatened by these people who were other than themselves. They were black. They were brown. They were a little bit darker than them. And they felt threatened by them. They absolutely felt threatened by them. And if some guy can get together with his posse friends and swoop up some black boy for making a pass at a white woman and he feels threatened, you know, because he knows that white woman. It's only, and the law will say, who cares? Who's going to stop that? I mean, everyone always looks at laws in the current, right? They always say, okay, well, now this is how it's going to progress. But very few people, and I hear lawyers doing this now on some of the podcasts that I listen to. But how many people stop and think and say, in one generation, or in even a quarter of a generation, 8, 9, 10 years, how is this going to be perceived? See, because, yes, in this generation, we may understand why it's happening, why we need that legislation, and truthfully, we don't even need stand your ground legislation, but how about in 15 years, when you have kids who were brought up under that legislation? If you have kids who are brought up under that legislation, how are they going to view it? How are they going to view it? I mean, my God, it was used to excuse the murder of a black boy by two rival gangs who were shooting it out and one of the stray bullets hit him. It was used to excuse that. How the hell do you excuse that? We're degenerating. Right in front of my eyes, we're degenerating as a society. And I was listening to, ironically, a speech by Michael Moore. And please don't turn off the podcast after hearing that. But he made a statement, and it's very apt. He made a statement about leadership. And it's so true, what he said. And I'm not going to play it. But I will try to isolate the clip and post it sometime or another. He made a statement about people on the left not wanting to lead. And he's so right. So many people think by leading organizations and basic organizations and, you know, kind of working, not in the shadows, but working in the underground with these leftist organizations, that they're going to impact things on a grandiose scale. But you can't do that. You need true, visionary, conscious leaders who are going to step up and lead the people. Like Michael Moore said, we have the majority. Poll after poll after poll after poll says that conscious, progressive, almost, and he didn't say this, but I'm saying it's almost feminine, nurturing legislation is supported. Equalizing, stabilizing legislation is supported. People have to rise now to just lead through the darkness to get there. And we have some powerful people who, if they would just step up, it would work. I mean, the reality is, like someone like Cynthia McKinney, who I have so much tremendous respect for, you know, she is in some ways a very dynamic leader, and she could be a incredible legislative leader. You know, she's been shut out of the Democratic Party, which is just a corporocrat party now. You know, we used to have the Dixiecrats, right? Well, now we have the corporocrats. That's what the majority of them are. They're corporocrats. Well, you know, Van Jones could be a very interesting city, urban leader, if he wasn't so married to the Democratic Party. I think Jaziri X could be a hell of a hip-hop leader. But I guess the question then becomes, you know, after going through some of the people who could be leaders, well, How do you lead? Well, first and foremost, you have to build strong institutions that aren't underground. So, for instance, with someone like Jaziri X, you need a major record label to be developed where conscious artists, not only rap artists, but all kinds of artists could find a home, and you can shower this nation with real conscious music on a level that cannot be ignored. On a level that cannot be ignored. And when I say a level that cannot be ignored, on this major label, you want 70 or 80 or 100 artists, and you want at least half of them putting out albums within the first 3 years. And then in the second 2 years, you want everyone to put out at least one album. They can't ignore it then. Why not? Because you put together a marketing plan that puts that music right where people need it. You use social media, you use the internet, you use high schools, you put the music where the kids are. You use the same tactics that big corporations are using to subvert the will of people, to elevate the will of people. That's what you got to do. You get into the mind of the slave master, and you use his own tactics against him. That's one way, you know, someone like Jaziri X. Then you need, you know, for like Cynthia McKinney, you need a people's legislative exchange, kind of like Alec, to couple people in their legislators and to create legislation that could really help people. You also will need, of course, a social justice grouping like the SCLC used to be before it became corporatized. I mean, these are things that would need to be done. You'd have to elevate and create new foundational institutions to get us to the point where we need to be as a society. That includes creating a new media stream. That would include creating a new media stream. Now, of course, many of you are probably saying, wow, you know, I can't believe that we went from Trayvon Martin to, you know, Stand Your Ground, and now we're talking about, you know, solutions. Well, like I said before, when I see these things, I don't see them for what they are now. I see what they could turn into. By the way, we also would need a prison mission based on social justice. We would need a prison mission based on social justice. Start elevating the minds in prison. Get those people out working for themselves. This is what needs to be done to save ourselves. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, let's be real about it. Let's be real about it. We are in crises as a society. If we don't turn around now, we're going to hit a very dark place. Like I said, Trayvon Martin could be that spark. Troy Davis was the start. Trayvon Martin is the continuation. Now all we have to do is just take that spark and move somewhere. All right. I want to thank you for listening. As always, you can send comments to ClashWarBattlefieldPodcast@live.com. This is Vimer D saying, keep the flames of revolution alive in your mind, in your heart. And remember, social justice is about agape love. And you cannot love if you hate. Peace.
Metro Police Department, line is being recorded to Sean.
Hey, we've had some break-ins in my neighborhood, and there's a real suspicious guy. It's Retrieve Circle. The best address I can give you is 111 Retrieve Circle. This guy looks like he's up to no good, or he's on drugs or something. It's raining, and he's just walking around looking about.
Okay, and this guy, is he white, black, or Hispanic?
He looks black.
Did you see what he was wearing?
Yeah. A dark hoodie, like a gray hoodie, and either jeans or sweatpants and white tennis shoes. He's here now. He was just staring.
Oh, he's just walking around the area?
At all the houses.
Okay.
And now he's just staring at me.
Okay, he said it's 1111 Retrieve You or 111?
That's the clubhouse.
That's the clubhouse. Do you know what he's near the clubhouse right now?
Yeah, now he's coming towards me.
Okay.
He's got his hand in his waistband. And he's a black male.
Okay. How old would you say he looks?
He's got a button on his shirt. Late teens.
Late teens, okay.
Mm-hmm. Something's wrong with him. Yep. He's coming to check me out. He's got something on his hands. I don't know what his deal is.
Okay, just let me know if he does anything, okay?
Over here.
Yeah, we got him on the way. Just let me know if this guy does anything else.
Okay. These assholes, they always get away. Yeah. When you come to the clubhouse, you come straight in and make a left. Actually, you would go past the clubhouse.
Okay, it says on the left-hand side from the clubhouse?
No, you go in straight through the entrance, and then you make a left. You go straight in, don't turn and make a left. Shit, he's running.
He's running? Which way is he running?
Down towards the other entrance of the neighborhood.
Okay, which entrance is that he's heading towards?
The back entrance.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
Okay. 911, you need police, fire, medical? Maybe both, I'm not sure. There's just someone screaming outside.
Okay, what's the address that they're near? Okay, and is it a male or a female?
It sounds like a male.
Okay, and you don't know why?
I don't know why. I think they're yelling help, but I don't know. Just send someone quick. Say, stop.
Does he look hurt to you?
I can't see him. I don't want to go out there. I don't know what's going on. So they're sending.
So you think he's yelling help?
Yes.
All right, what is your...
There's gunshots.
You just heard gunshots?
Yes.
How many?
Just one.
These children, unoffending, innocent, and beautiful, were the victims of one of the most vicious and tragic crimes ever perpetrated against humanity. And yet they died nobly. They are the martyred herons of a holy crusade for freedom and human dignity. And so this afternoon, in a real sense, they have something to say to each of us in that death. They have something to say to every minister of the gospel who has remained silent behind the safe security of stained glass windows. They have something to say to every politician who has fed his constituents with the stale bread of hatred and the spoiled meat of racism. They have something to say to a federal government that has compromised with the undemocratic practices of Southern Dixiecrats and the blatant hypocrisy of right-wing Northern Republicans. They have something to say to every Negro who has passively accepted the evil system of segregation and who has stood on the sidelines in a mighty struggle for justice. They say to each of us, black and white alike, that we must substitute courage for caution. They say to us that we must be concerned not merely about who murdered them, but about the system, the way of life, the philosophy which produced the murderers. That death says to us that we must work passionately and unrelentingly for the realization of the American dream. And so, my friends, they did not die in vain. God still has a way of wringing good out of evil. And history has proven over and over again that unmerited suffering is redemptive. The innocent blood of these little girls may well serve as a redemptive force that will bring new light to this dark city. The Holy Scripture says, a little child shall lead them. The death of these little children may lead our whole Southland from the low road of man's inhumanity to man to the high road of peace and brotherhood. These tragic deaths may lead our nation to substitute an aristocracy of character for an aristocracy of color. The spilled blood of these innocent girls may cause the whole citizenry of Birmingham to transform the negative extremes of a dark past into the positive extremes of a bright future. Indeed, this tragic event may cause the White South to come to terms with its conscience. And so I stand here to say this afternoon to all assembled here that in spite of the darkness of this hour, we must not despair. We must not become bitter. Nor must we harbor the desire to retaliate with violence. No, we must not lose faith in our white brothers. Somehow we must believe that the most misguided among them can learn to respect the dignity and the worth of all human personality.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, my friends. My name is Fire Mary Deese, and welcome to another Class War Battlefield podcast. As you can tell by the introduction to the show today, I'm obviously going to be talking about Trayvon Martin. The speech that you heard following those terrible, terrible 911 calls was, of course, Martin Luther King giving a eulogy for the three slain girls. I think it was three. It's been a long time since I've watched Spike Lee's movie on the subject. But the three slain girls in the Birmingham church. Of course, put some music behind it, and it's a funeral march, actually. It was a brilliant piece of classical music that I've heard before. And before I continue, let me apologize. I am a little sick this week, but I'm definitely looking forward to getting this out because there's just so much going on with Trayvon Martin. I have some clips that I'm going to play about it and make some comments on it. I've wrestled with how I wanted to approach this because on the one hand, there's a part of me that's very discouraged by what's happening. There's another part of me that's not surprised. And then there's kind of a third part of me that's angry at myself for not being much more angrier. And I think ironically, there is a person in my life who is kind of personifies the feeling, this third feeling within me. And it's a boss of mine. He's a real upstanding guy. and he is just enraged and incensed about this. He doesn't understand it. He has said numerous times to me while we were talking about it that it's just a travesty, it's a miscarriage of justice. And you know, he also points out, he goes, look, I don't care if it's black or white, you know, this is just how it is. And, you know, I don't have the heart to tell him, but it, everybody who continues to say it doesn't matter, you know, that it's black and white, they fail to see the reality that it does matter in this nation if you're black or if you're white. That's the reality. Later I'm going to play a quick comment that I put together, or a part of the quick comment, because it was roughly about 20 minutes. And there's about 10 minutes that I want you to definitely hear. The rest of it, I'll probably post separately, but the 10 minutes has to actually deal with Trevon, and I recorded this last week. And I think you'll see just exactly how dismayed I was, and still am, about this whole thing. I make a very, very, very bold statement that in America, there's no justice for black people. It's just one long injustice, and I want to talk about that today. I want to give voice to that. Black people tend to not like to, I think, harp on these things because we are already portrayed in the media as not being grateful for the little that we have. And truthfully, it is kind of a mockery to our internal worth not to give voice to the fact that we are very discontented with where we are in history as black Americans. You know, this whole concept of African American, I'm glad about it, you know, but you know, like I keep telling my white friends, Marcus Garvey was asking that we be called African Americans, and in the 40s, he was. Malcolm X was asking in the 60s. They still called us Negroes into the 70s. I mean, so you know, how much progress are we making? It took us what 60 plus years? Or 60 years for white folks to get comfortable enough to call us African Americans? That's not progress. That's slow. There's no reason for that. But you know, I'll hit a little bit on that. I'm also going to talk a little bit about black leadership and what Haiti tells us about black leadership in America, or what it should tell us about black leadership in America. And we're going to do some talking about Occupy Wall Street and infiltration of Occupy Wall Street, because it's underway. We've known it was underway. And I have this brilliant clip, which I think so many of you are going to both love it and hate it, because it's going to show you exactly where the mindset of corporations and unfortunately our government is. I keep telling my friends that, you know, the police in many of the major cities are not for the people. You know, I had this conversation a couple of months ago, well, more than a couple months ago now, when Occupy Wall Street was first being raided. A friend of mine posted on my Facebook page that the police were peace officers, and I just I was a little bit beside myself. I said to this young lady, I said, yeah, well, unfortunately, history suggests the exact opposite. Said, history definitely suggests the exact opposite. And she didn't want to hear it, and she accused me of having my mind made up, which I thought was really interesting, because like I told her, if my mind is, quote, made up, well, it's because historically, this is what police have done. And this is, they haven't been for the ordinary people. The majority of the time, when push came to shove, they were for the elite. They were for the people with money. That's not keeping peace. That's being hired guns. Moreover, if my mind is made up, it's because historically, that's what it's about. And come to find out in the next week, in a week and a half afterwards, guess what we found out? We found out that all this money was exchanging hands, and the police, the New York PD, were getting grants for certain things from these big companies who happen to have a stake in the park. So, you know, I ended up being right on that matter. But, you know, it's neither here nor there. The reality is, while I believe there are some good cops who genuinely, you know, want to see this thing thrive, and do not want to see the people or the groups infiltrated and what have you, you know, there's a certain type of person that goes into policing. But I'll talk about that later too. First of all, I want to handle a little bit of business here, and say to you that from this point on, Class War Battlefield Podcast will exclusively be located on Radio4All.net. I invite everybody who goes there to download. And actually, I encourage and implore you, please, if you go to radioforall.net and you download this podcast, take 2 seconds to click support our project and donate $1. Or donate 50 cents. Just donate it. I mean, look, it's a great service. I'm not going to spend time, you know, hitting you about this, but you know, just 50 cents or a dollar. I've resigned myself to kind of do that over the coming weeks. Just every time I go there to download my podcast, I'm giving them $1. $1. Boom. And that's it. That's it. $1. Boom. You don't have to do 10. You don't have to do 20. $1. This is a great project. And also, your other podcasts, encourage them, write to them, say, I love you a lot. Let's make you national. Go to radioforall.net and upload your podcast. So, you know, we can get more content on there, especially liberal, progressive, revolutionary, and radical. With that out the way, about the show, I have some changes coming up that you'll notice. I'll be doing music breaks, like minute-long music breaks, sometimes less. And the reason why I'm going to be doing those music breaks, it's very simple, very, very simple. I record this podcast, the longer version, in segments throughout the week or the 2 or 3 weeks that I take to prep one show. And you will be able to tell the difference. You will. I'm not trying to hide that. But for different segments, to kind of, you know, fit them together, you need filler. And so that's what I'm going to use for my fillers, those music breaks. Now, if you have a music suggestion, conscious music, ladies and gentlemen, conscious music, politically relevant music, you can always write to me at classwarbattlefieldpodcast@live.com, and I'm still looking for the 1 to 2 minute audios blocks about news going on in your community, or maybe just an opinion you have about something I said. I'm looking for that still, and I definitely invite you to send me those things. High quality, please, high quality, at classwarbattlefieldpodcast@live.com. By the way, in case you didn't know, most cell phones have a voice recorder, so you should be able to use that, or even your MP3 players. Most MP3 players have a voice recorder, so you also can use that. With that said, here comes our first music break, and I'll see you on the other side.
The definition of truth, he is more real than you, isn't he? Old Maggie Doctor must have been a heavenly man. Jesus, lot of inspiration. All over this land, Jesus. Spite of your fears, you can shed happy tears. Jesus. Don't care what you call him, none can befall him. Hear me say amen.
Amen, amen.
Hear me say amen.
Amen, amen.
Now stand up and clap your hands. A traveling soul, the way the story goes. We all know he was crucified, but what he gave us never will die. He never had a hustling mind,
doing crime, wasting time,
drinking that wine. You need courage in time of fear, because of undying news you hear.
Talk about Jesus. Talk about Jesus.
Strength in time, new temptation. Don't wanna lose a love relation.
Talk about Jesus. Jesus.
He never had a hustling mind,
doing crime, wasting time,
drinking that wine,
my friends, I'll tell you, if you don't know who that is playing in the back of me right now, I almost feel sorry for you. That is the great, great, great Curtis Mayfield, and I decided to go off with this song, Jesus, not for any religious meaning, but for the spiritual quality of it. It is the way he tells the story is just magnificent, and it's almost I think it's a dedication to Trevon, because of you know, you'll hear later on in a clip that I'm going to play that he's described as having a little angelic face, and you know, I think many people would describe Jesus in that way, whether you believe that he should be painted as a black man or painted as a white man. He still has that angelic face, but and that was a little bit longer than a minute. I couldn't convince myself to cut it off, but I hope you enjoyed it. Not every bit of music that I play is going to be that subtle or that quiet. Actually, probably in the next little break, I'm going to play one of my favorite Tupac songs. You'll notice I use a lot of Tupac instrumentals in this thing. I love Tupac, and I don't believe he gets enough respect from the mainstream media, but, you know, his instrumentals are incredibly deathful, so I'll use them a lot as my background. Okay, so I'm going to start off by playing an array of clips. And in between each of those clips, I'm going to insert a little bit of music. And I want to kind of, you know, set up the board for Trayvon Martin. And then I'll come back and give some commentary and really dive into this whole situation. And really talk about the supposed black leadership that has kind of come out of the woodwork to try to lead their people. And, I was listening to a podcast. I guess before I get going with that, I definitely want to bring this point up. I was listening to a podcast, and I might even play the clip later, where this other black gentleman, who also does a marvelous show called Black Talk Radio, was saying that he's kind of resigned to himself. He's a bit older than me. He doesn't want to attack black leaders anymore. You know, we got to get together and stuff. And he was saying he just doesn't want to kind of descend into attacking the black leaders. And I found myself thinking that, you know, these are not true black leaders. They deserve to be attacked. They are basically courtiers for the system. And knowing the history, as I do now, I didn't know it 2 years ago, of exactly how determined the FBI was, how determined various agencies within the government were to discourage blacks in general from, I would say, participating in the political arena in such, you know, sufficient force that they can actually change it. Some people might disagree with that, but basically it was to neutralize the racial problem. And there's a book which is not all that great. I've mentioned this before in my first new format podcast, that there's a book called Racial Matters, but it's not as well written as I might have think it would have been, but it does bring up a lot of points that are intriguing. But knowing the history as I know now, you know, these individuals, as Malcolm X said many times, they're on the plantation. I mean, you know, Herman Cain is on the plantation. Herman Cain is, you know, so far up, as we might say, masters behind, that he cannot, you cannot tell where the master ends and he begins. You know, it's almost like that half-human, half-horse sculpture, you know. Herman Cain is the horse part, you know. But these other plantation leaders, many of which are in the Democratic Party, are equally corrupted, and you know they themselves participate in the neutralizing of black folks. So, you know, I say, you're not attacking these people because they're black. You're not attacking them because, you know, they're upstanding community members. You're attacking them because they're not. And they purport to be, and they're not. You know, I heard this great quote the other day, and I wish I could find it in his voice. You know, it's difficult to find a lot of things by Fred Hampton, but I heard a quote from him the other day where he said that, you know, Negroes, back, of course, in the 70s, we were still, they were trying to, you know, blacks were trying to be known as blacks, and yet, you know, it was, we were still Negroes. So he said, you know, soon, you know, we'll have Negroes who want more and more and more and more, and soon we'll have Negro imperialists. And that's what these people are. Barack Hussein Obama is a Negro imperialist. And, you know, it's, you know, I'm not ashamed to say that. I would have been angry at myself a couple of years ago for saying it. But he is. John Lewis, you know, everybody likes to say veteran, veteran of civil rights movement, civil rights icon. Yeah, but to what extent now? You know, I mean, he bailed, basically, when you had individuals, and misguided, may I say, they were, like Stokely Carmichael and some of the, what we would call, black power movementeers who were starting to come into SNCC and everything like that. As soon as you started having those more radical elements, and by the way, radical is just a term for getting, you know, it means to get to the root. But when you had some of these more radical elements coming in, John Lewis couldn't handle it. And he bolted. The reality is, you know, as much as us black people like to talk about the white bourgeoisie, and, you know, before all of you start sweating and saying, oh my God, he used a term that, you know, communist, you know, get over yourself. Please get over yourself. Bourgeoisie was not meant for the communists, nor was it meant for socialists. It's to describe a class of people. But we like to talk about the quote, white elite. Us black people don't like to talk about the black elite. Because when we do start to talk about the black elite, we come into a brick wall. We have to see the reality that a lot of the people who we put our faith in, they don't care anything about us. I mean, my God, look at the number of black individuals who are making tons of money via sports. What are they doing with it? Okay, very few of them are putting things together in their communities. A lot of them are doing that. But you're talking about over $1 billion, you know, over probably the span of a 10-year period, if not every year, that these people are making put together, I mean, in aggregate. Why the heck is there no national, group with these sports players? It's, you know, there could be many reasons for it. But as you'll see when I do get into the whole black leadership thing, you know, the government has been trying successfully, and doing it successfully, to basically, to stop anything like that from ever growing up. One of the things that I've recently learned, you know, as I say, I'm a big fan of Martin Luther King, is the government were stymieing his efforts to connect the civil rights movement with the labor rights movement. And there was a time when he was very close to connecting SCLC with UAW. And let me tell you, if that would have happened, it would have been, oh my God, it for both parties, it would have been a new day. I mean, SCLC would have had a foothold in the urban ghettos in the north, and the UAW would have had a whole new group of individuals to unionize, a group of individuals who were becoming conscious and radical, and the government feared that. So, you know, to me it's not a big stretch to go from that and to where we are today. One other thing before I get going, I know I actually didn't expect to talk about all this yet, but, you know, when the spirit hits you, you move with it, right? So, this whole black leadership thing, right, and ratio matters. The reporter that wrote the book, and again, it's not as well written as it should be, but he brings up some interesting points, and he cites a lot of things. One of the things that he points out is that the Urban League, I believe it was the Urban League, yeah, the predecessor to the FBI had replaced the man at the top of the Urban League with their man. Meaning, they had already infiltrated that organization to the extent where they basically controlled it. They owned the man at the top. Now, think about this. The history of the civil rights movement, there's two organizations that you hear a lot about. SCLC and the NAACP. You do not hear about the Urban League. And I'm not saying that the Urban League didn't do stuff during that time period. It would be ignorant to say that, because they did. But they didn't play a prominent role, and considering how old they were, they should have. Now, Malcolm X contended for a long time that the national leaders were just dupes and what have you. And I believe that when King, when he was running around the nation giving marvelous speeches about love and don't fight back, and, you know, he was saying basically to sit there and just keep marching and it would happen. The, you know, black people would finally get the civil rights. He was beloved by the establishment because black people were doing that. They were doing that. But when King began to really see it, see the reality that throughout all the marching, throughout everything that he did, there had been so little progress. I mean, think about it. Voting rights didn't happen until 1965. And if it wasn't for the murder of those kids, it would have never happened. Well, it was when he decided that, you know, we need to do more. General strikes need to be called. You know, we need to get connected with all of these other groups that are expanding and growing conscious, growing in a conscious manner. Did the establishment kind of look at him and say, okay, we no longer need you. You are a problem now. You know, Malcolm X was a problem. They took care of Malcolm X. King became a problem. He was also taken care of. Now, what am I basing this on? Because obviously, you know, a lot of you are probably like, wow, this is a strange area to delve into for class war. But you have to understand, class war takes place on many levels. We usually only see the psychological level and the brute force level. We don't see the higher levels where it's like, okay, where the strategy takes place. We don't see that. So that's what I'm doing. I'm kind of peeling back the onion a little bit and saying, okay, you know something? This is where I see the strategy. This is how I see the strategy happening. Martin King, I think for a while, was, in some means or another, I don't think he knew it, but I think he was the establishment's best friend. And it was because of the fact that he was able to, you know, he was able to calm the flames of the Negro, as it was back then. He was able to get more radical elements to calm down. Malcolm X came along, and Malcolm X shook it up and said, no, we need those radical elements. Martin might have disagreed with him for a while, but then Martin came around. When he came around, and when he started seeing the reality, and he started speaking truth to power, and he was murdered, I am in 100% belief that the only reason why he was murdered was because he talked about poverty, and he talked about why poverty existed, and he talked about why racism existed, and he talked about a new conscious way of living. I have this podcast that I haven't published yet, but I make the brief argument that the counter-enlightenment movement, and anybody who doesn't know what that is, just Google it. You know, I have some stuff on it. I might have to post it with this. But the counter-enlightenment movement is basically a counter-consciousness movement, and that the people at the top of this nation, they've been fighting this conscious movement for a long time. They don't want it to happen, because when you become conscious, you become more of a humanitarian. When you become more of a humanitarian, you start to see competition for what it is. You can either have competition for sport, or you can have competition for destruction. And when you have competition for destruction, you destroy everything. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You destroy everything. It may start off that you're destroying something in your general facility or vicinity. I do apologize for that. But, you know, after a while, you blow everything up. It spins out of control. It's like having a black hole in a chamber. That black hole is only going to stay in that chamber for a few moments. Then it's going to spin out of control, and hopefully it doesn't swallow the whole planet. Don't know why that just came up, but it did. But when Martin started speaking that truth to power, you know, he started talking about that consciousness, and these people they became afraid because he was powerful. And they have watched for people like him, and they have neutralized people like him, because they don't want consciousness to happen. They don't want it. Capitalism goes away when consciousness hits. That's what happens. Capitalism goes away. All you have to do to see this is look what happened in the 60s. In the 60s, and I didn't realize this. I was listening to another podcast, and a gentleman talking about the work habits of Americans and how they've changed. He said this, and it just completely blew me away. In the 60s, the average person worked less than 35 hours a week. Let me say that again. The average person in the 1960s worked less than. I'm not talking about worked at. They worked less than 35 hours a week. That's not a 9-to-5 job. You know, Dolly Parton did that song, I'm working a 9-to-5. 9-to-5? In the 60s, it would have been like 9-to-3. Or, you know, 9-to-4. How did we get from working less than 35 hours a week to working 40 or 50? I mean, either way, I mean, it's a good question, but not where I was going with it. All you have to do is look at what happened when people were working those hours. People had time to be concerned about their communities and society in general. And a long while ago, you know, when I was in high school, I had this thought, and it just kind of occurred to me, that what the power elite learned from the 60s was, if you allow people to work less hours, and I don't even know how I knew this back then, but if you allow people to have too much time on their hands, what are they going to do? They're going to demonstrate, they're going to get out on the streets, and they're going to say, we demand a better society. That's what they're going to do. And so the power elite said, you know something? We need to change it so these people do not have that kind of time. And thus, the 40-hour work week and the 45-hour work week and the 50-hour work week was created. And an atmosphere of indentured servitude. This is something that we don't even talk about in this country. But we have a proto-slavery society. It doesn't look like slavery, but it is. Neither we have a involuntary an indentured servitude society where people work to pay off a debt that they automatically occur when they're born. This is me personally, this is what I think the concept of sin really means in our wonderful economically driven based society, that when you're born, you already have a price tag on you. You owe something. And soon, you know, it turns into, of course, student debt, house debt, car debt, blah, blah, blah. So you basically don't own any part of your life. You're always indentured to something else. But I suppose I'll get into that a little bit more later. With the whole Martin Luther King thing, though, when he started talking about consciousness and they became afraid, and then, you know, they, basically a year after he came out against the Vietnam War, he was murdered, right? Well, there is this interesting article, and I've heard it referenced, I haven't been able to find it, and I bet it, I believe, where Martin Luther King came out against the Vietnam War, and I believe it was the next day or someday after that, which lets me know that this was something that didn't come out willy-nilly. This was something that was planned, you know. Everybody knows that King's senior staff was thoroughly infiltrated. I'll tell you, there's a couple of individuals that I have from his staff that, you know, I've learned things about that I'm pretty confident to this day that they were informants, but that's for another day. But, you know, that the op-ed obviously was planned and timed to come out after he came out against the Vietnam War. Well, in that op-ed, the person who wrote it said that King had surpassed his usefulness, I believe were the words. But the term usefulness was in there, the word, the phrase. And to me, that's the mark of death for King. That when King read that, he had to know, okay, now I'm a target. I'm a target for elimination. And it's been difficult for me because I've been trying to get my hands on so many of his sermons from this era of his life. You can look at the titles of his sermons and the titles of his speeches, and you can tell that King is becoming more and more and more radical. He's starting to see the connections. He's going to the root of the problem. And he's speaking candidly about the future of our society. Now, I know this was not supposed to be a big thing about King and blah, 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 but ladies and gentlemen, you have to understand, King was probably the last saint that we have in this nation. And I'm not saying that we don't have any good people, but I'm talking about, you know, a messiah is a person who comes with an elevated message. And King was probably the last one of those that we have to redeem this nation. If we are going to redeem this nation now, it's up to us. It's up to a group of people getting together. I'm not saying I'm part of that group. I'm saying a group of conscious people who base, you know, whatever their movements are on a couple of things. You know, I often tell people to pick up King's Level of Love sermon. and read it and study it. I mean, digest it. These conscious people need to have a agape love perspective. You know, everyone talks about nonviolence when it comes to OWS, but people fail to realize that there is a deeper rhythm within nonviolence. And it's the whole rising to agape love. We need to have a humanitarian view of our nation and our world. So whoever's in this conscious group, they need to have that humanitarian view. Because within the humanitarian view is a love that is embracing of all of humanity. Of all of humanity. So those are definitely, those are things that you have to put at the center of everything. But, you know, I think I've gone on for long enough here. We're going to take another quick break, and then we're going to get into some of these clips. Then I'm going to come back, and we're going to have some more discussion. All right. This is Vi Meredith. I'll see you in a moment.
Why did Staff Sergeant Robert Bales kill 16 Iraqi civilians in the deep of night and supposedly all by himself in the countryside of a foreign land? Why did George Zimmerman stalk and then kill 17-year-old Trayvon Martin as the 140-pound kid talked on a cell phone with his girlfriend in a gated community near Orlando, Florida? Bales and Zimmerman did it because they could, because they felt they had permission to snuff out the lives of Iraqis and black teenagers who had never even thought to offend them. The only reason that these two instances of murder are of such deep importance in the larger scheme of things, rather than just to the families and neighbors of the victims and the killers, is because both murderers had good reason to believe that American society would approve of what they did. Certainly, Sergeant Bales thought so. He had served 3 tours in Iraq after joining the Army at the ripe old age of 27, right after 9/11. The hyper-nationalist media constantly told him and the rest of the American public that the troops were heroes who were not only serving their own country, but also doing a great favor for the Iraqis and the Afghans. If the people of Iraq and Afghanistan didn't appreciate the presence of Sergeant Bales and his fellow soldiers and Marines, well, they were ingrates of the worst kind, unworthy of the sacrifice of even one of Sergeant Bales' buddies. Besides, they were all Hajis, a slur for Muslims that has the same venomous connotation as nigger. Sergeant Bales wasn't ashamed to use the term Haji in letters to his wife, so I guess he had reason to believe she was a racist, too. The U.S. military preferred to descend on villages late at night when they had the advantage of surprise and night vision goggles and could wipe out whole extended families of Taliban, or people who were pronounced to be Taliban post-mortem, usually without suffering a single casualty. We own the night, that's what the Americans said, and nighttime is for killing Hajis. George Zimmerman had every reason to believe that Florida's Stand Your Ground law was written especially for him, and actually it was. The Stanford, Florida Police Department clearly thought the law was meant to protect Zimmerman from murder charges, which is why they claimed they didn't arrest him. When Zimmerman called the local cops from his SUV to tell them he was stalking Trayvon Martin, he confided to them that assholes, like the unknown black kid, always get away. But this one wouldn't get away, not with his life. Florida and lots of other states in recent years have noted that too many black people are getting away with life and need to be stopped. So they crafted legislation that would allow white fear to trump black rights to breathe air. In such jurisdictions, evocation of white fear now provides the same justification for summary murder as claims of rape of white women did for mob lynchings back in the day. It's as if the Florida legislature had put out a call for black people to be summarily shot all over the state when it passed the bill. The racial intention was clear, the results totally predictable. George Zimmerman doesn't seem like a very bright young man, but even he knew that Florida civil society wanted some black folks dead. Sergeant Bales and Steve Zimmerman murdered Afghans and an African-American kid because they could, and because American society told them that they should. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Looking back, I can see the things I should have done, could have done. I see so much of my life I let go by. But when you're young, all you know how to do is run. Life can play tricks sometimes, you know. You think you got everything when you got nothing at all. The only way you know where you're going, you gotta take a fall. You've got to lose it all. I've been through love.
I'm coming
home. I've been through some pain, I know.
Another area that we need to focus on is this no snitching in our neighborhood. We have to stop killing each other. We have to become more involved in the community. We have to reach out to these young brothers out there that's shooting each other. And most of it has to do with drug-related crime. Okay? I do not advocate people using drugs. I don't advocate people using alcohol or tobacco for that matter. And so I definitely don't advocate people out there selling drugs. Do I understand why people out there are selling drugs? Yeah, I understand it. Look at the high unemployment in the black community. Look at the discrimination that you see in the job market. You know, the Cows, one of our other media partners, which is also streaming live right now at this time on Black Talk Radio Network. And, you know, we got archives, so you can check them out later if you choose. And they brought on this lady who was talking about she applied for all these jobs. She was highly qualified in the insurance industry, applied for all these jobs on Monster.com, and didn't get not one phone call. not even an email, nothing, to acknowledge that they got her a resume. So she makes up a fake profile and uses a non-ethnic sounding name. I don't remember the name she used, but she made up a fake profile, put her ethnicity down as white, and you can get the details by, I guess, going to the cows and looking through their archives. But then the phone started ringing off the hook. So I understand why these brothers out there selling dope, okay? You still poisoning our people. You still being a tool of the system of oppression because, you know, don't look. It should be no secret to anyone that the government is involved in this drug dealing and trafficking. It is the perfect trap. Okay? They allow either bring the drugs in or allow the drugs in and then allow it to be sold. And then they come in and they bust you and they take the money that you made off of it and they split it between themselves. They take the property, auction it off. Okay? And then guess what? They're going to put your butt in a privatized prison and make money off of you as a 21st century slave because slavery wasn't abolished. Read the Constitution. It was never abolished. But we have to stop killing each other. If we want people, other people who don't look like us to respect our lives, to value our lives, then we have to start valuing our acting like we value our lives. Not acting, that was the wrong word, excuse me. We have to value our own lives, and we have to value the lives of our brothers and sisters. And this stuff starts at a young age. For those that know me, y'all know I grew up in Detroit as a young man, all the way up till I was 12 years old, and then we came back home to North Carolina, where all my people live. And I got recruited into a drug gang, and how they recruited me was to, you know, send four or five guys to jump on me every day until I joined them. Then hanging around with them guys, one guy in particular, he's dead now, and it wasn't surprising when I found out that he had been killed, got shot in the back of the head before he even turned 16. But this guy was dangerous, and he would just shoot at anybody just for fun and kill people for fun. I've heard people recently in the past couple of days say white people kill for fun. Guess what? Black people do too. And he was one of those people. I remember we was walking across the football field, and the YMs, no, it was a boys' club. This fool pulls out his little .22. And just start shooting at the freaking building. This in a black neighborhood. Just shooting at the door. Anybody could have came out that door, been standing behind that door. I probably wouldn't be alive today if my mother did not pick up and leave and come back down here to the south, to the country. So we have to stop. We have to address the violence in our communities.
Feel me, I'm going in. I was about 13, as I recall, just a young whippersnapper playing ball, trying to hang out with the homies after dark. We used to slap box until the street lights come on, and I can hear my mama yelling that it's time to come home. But being young, you know how hard-headed we were. And I can clearly remember all of the other kids laughing at me, because I used to wear those hand-me-downs. But if only they can see me now. And every now and then I reminisce about it. Well, baby, that's life as well as you know, when you come straight from the ghetto.
Hey yo, hey yo,
oh yeah.
Give me some of that, give me some of that
good old ghetto.
Back as a kid again,
and you know, and you know,
hey yo,
and you know.
Give me some of that, give me some of that
good old ghetto.
These are my sweet ghetto memories.
We ain't ghetto food. We wore ghetto clothes.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Joining me now is Leo Thomas, a criminal defense attorney in Florida. As most of you know, the entire country has been focused on Florida laws for several weeks in the wake of the killing of the 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Martin was killed by a neighborhood watch captain who is yet to be charged with crimes, thanks to an NRA-sponsored law known as Stand Your Ground. So, Leo, let's go over just a little bit of what we know at this point of the Trayvon Martin case. Trayvon Martin, 17-year-old African-American student, was walking home from a 7-Eleven. He had bought some snacks. He was watching the NBA All-Star game. He's walking back through a gated community where his father lived. And then just tell us what we at first believed happened.
Well, at first, it appeared, listening to that Zimmerman guy, that he was walking with some sort of evil purpose to do something, and he described him, and this is where the racism starts in the very beginning, when he says he looks like he's on drugs and he's black, and as if that was part of the reason why he was suspicious of him.
And this is George Zimmerman you're talking about. He is the captain of this neighborhood watch. It turns out he may very well be the only person in this neighborhood
watch. Well, I'm not sure that he was a member of the neighborhood watch. You're right, unless he was doing it, you know, solo.
And he is calling this into the police on a 911 call. We know this because the audio has been released.
Right.
And he is suspicious of this kid basically because of the way he's dressed, because he's black.
Primarily because he's black. I mean, that's exactly what it is. Because the kid was not doing anything at all that was in any way improper. So that's what it was. I mean, it's clear racism as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that aside, I mean, because the racism of Zimmerman, to me, is only a very small part of this story, because there's a couple other elements to this. One is the way that the police responded to this killing. And then the second is the sort of broader context in which this killing took place, which, of course, is the Stand Your Ground law. Tell us about the Stand Your Ground law, what it is, how it was formed there in Florida, and what role Jeb Bush had in with it.
Yeah, but first, dealing with the racism, in other words, if that young man had been a white young man walking through that neighborhood, this would never have happened.
Right.
Because he wouldn't have confronted him. So racism has a lot to do with it. If that young man was white and had been shot by somebody, the police would have done everything would have notified the parents, would have gone over, instead of letting that young man's body lay there for 2 or 3 days. So that's what really gets to me. Now, the Stand Your Ground law was passed several years ago, and it was intended to protect people in their homes and in their cars primarily, so that the way it stands now, if you are in your car or in your home and someone enters it using force or attempts to remove you, there is a presumption that you are in fear of your life or of great bodily harm, and therefore you can use deadly force. What it amounts to is, if anybody unknown to you enters your house, you shoot and kill him right there. Nothing. You're not going to be prosecuted. That's what it amounts to. And perhaps,
this basically lowers the standards in which someone who kills another person needs to achieve to prove that they took this act in self-defense.
Well, if you're in your home or in your car, which is one section of this law, there's very little doubt about it. You're going to be protected by the law from prosecution. Now, in this case, is not the same situation where you're in your home, your car, but you're on the street. And the question is, it's the Stand Your Ground law. Now, under the Stand Your Ground law, there is no presumption that whatever happens there, you can use deadly force. It has to be based on reasonable fear that you are in danger of being killed or suffering great bodily harm. And if you are, you have to be attacked. Under the evidence we have so far, this young man did not attack anybody. To the contrary. So that would rule out the use of the Stand Your Ground law just on that alone, that he was not attacked. Now, we don't know all the evidence, but we've heard the calls. Those calls are admissible, including the call that this young man was making to his girlfriend. That's admissible. in evidence and can be used. Now, you take that and put that together, there's enough to charge this guy with first-degree murder, because just the help screams alone give him sufficient time to premeditate, and it only takes seconds to form that intent. I would charge him with first-degree murder without a question in my mind.
Now, so we have a situation where this Zimmerman is sitting in the car. He, at one point, as he's talking to the police, reporting this supposed suspicious character, Trayvon Martin.
Right.
The police hear what we can hear clearly on the 911 recording is that it sounds as if a guy in a car has gotten out of his car, because we can hear the wind rushing through the phone line.
Right.
So much so that the police officer says, "Are you following him?" Zimmerman says, "Yes." The police said, "Don't do that."
Right.
And he says, "Okay." And then, like you mentioned, we know from the at least the reportedly the woman that he was the girl that he Trayvon Martin was speaking to, and that's been established by phone records that they were speaking.
Right.
She claims that he was afraid he was going to start walking faster, and then she hears him being confronted,
right,
and then the his phone knocked down. So all of that, and again, we're not in a position, we're not a court of law, this is just what we publicly know, but all of that, at the very least, certainly would lend a predisposition to believing that there was no reason for Zimmerman, when he was sitting in that car, if he had not injected himself into the situation, to ever feel any type of threat from Trayvon Martin, even without the knowledge that we have now that Trayvon Martin was only carrying a bag of Skittles and a soda.
Goes down on our side of town, on the other side of the block where cops hang around, on the same side of the street that Pac hit the ground. Not in Vegas, cause every nigga got Pac in them now. When my guys hit the block, and we proving we thugs. I ain't on no swim team, but you see pools of blood. Skip Judy when you die, she ain't who's to judge. Oh, you married to the game? Prove your love, prove it. Hit the strap, shorty, shoot it, do it, just do it. This ain't a game, it's an organized movement. My hurt, my love, my pain, my stress, my strife, my wife, my life, my test. We made for more, we die for less. When you starving in the ghetto, I'ma write the rest. See, my girl think I'm hard, and my mama think I'm hard, but when I'm all up in the dark, I just fall on my knees.
Which also included Steely Dan's The Royal Fam, They Might Be Giants with Your Racist Friend, Brother Louie, remember that one by The Stories, Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit, Alabama by Neil Young, and X got us started about a half hour ago with Los Angeles. And the thing, the theme from today's pre-show music was racism. And the reason is because I think it's pretty clear now that the murder of Trayvon Martin was racially motivated. And how do I know that? Well, boy, so much has transpired between yesterday and today. So let me fill you in on what's gone on. First of all, on ABC this morning, there was an interview, sort of, a phone interview with a girl who lives down here in South Florida in Miami Gardens, real close to where I used to live, by the way. And she said that Trayvon was on the phone with her seconds before he was killed. And we know that because the cell phone records show that they were talking. Here's the ABC News report from Good Morning America this morning.
Seconds before 17-year-old Trayvon Martin was killed, just yards from his house by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch volunteer, these call logs obtained by ABC News show he was on the phone with a 16-year-old girl. ABC News was there exclusively as an attorney for Martin's family prodded her late Monday about what she heard that night as she spoke to Martin on his cell phone.
He said his man was watching him, so he put his hoodie on.
The young woman's parents asked we not use her name and that only the attorney question her. She says suddenly Martin was cornered, asking the man,
"Tell us that what you following me for me. And the man from the cell, what you doing around here?" Somebody pushed Trayvon.
She says the line then went dead. Seconds later, Zimmerman shot Martin.
Wow. I'm pretty sure the guy's dead out here. Holy
The case has sparked national outrage and protests. Zimmerman confessed to the shooting, claiming self-defense. Martin's family says he was murdered. that the 17-year-old had only stepped out to buy candy during the NBA All-Star game. All that anger partly stoked by Zimmerman's call to police that night.
All right, I'm going to stop this here because that segment of that call, they actually edited out what, the first time I listened to the entire call, sounded like Zimmerman breathing heavily. All right, this is gonna freak you out. I'm gonna play the entire call. All right, the entire call, which you know most of the news outlets don't bother to play because it's long. All right, but I'm gonna play the entire call and then I'm gonna zoom in on the point at just about 2 minutes and 22 seconds into the call when it just sounds like a little bit of heavy breathing. All right, you ready? Here we go. Here's the entire 911 call.
Stafford Police Department. Line is being recorded. Sean.
Hey, we've had some break-ins in my neighborhood, and there's a real suspicious guy. It's Retrieview Circle. The best address I can give you is 111 Retrieview Circle. This guy looks like he's up to no good, or he's on drugs or something. It's raining, and he's just walking around looking about.
Okay, and this guy, is he white, black, or Hispanic?
He looks black.
Did you see what he was wearing?
Yeah, a dark hoodie, like a gray hoodie, and either jeans or sweatpants and white tennis shoes. He's here now. He was just staring.
Oh, he's just walking around the area?
Looking at all the houses.
Okay.
Now he's just staring at me.
Okay, he said it's 1111 Retrieview or 111?
That's the clubhouse.
That's the clubhouse. Do you know what the... He's near the clubhouse right now?
Yeah, now he's coming towards me.
Okay.
He's got his hand in his waistband. And he's a black male.
Okay. How old would you say he looks?
He's got a button on his shirt. Late teens.
Late teens, okay.
Mm-hmm. Something's wrong with him.
Something's wrong with him?
He's coming to check me out.
He's coming to check me
out?
He's got
something in his hands. I don't know what his deal is.
Okay, just let me know if he does anything, okay?
We got an officer over here.
Yeah, we got him on the way. Just let me know if this guy does anything else.
Okay. These assholes, they always get away.
These assholes, they always get away. Unreal.
Yeah. When you come to the clubhouse, you come straight in and make a left. Actually, you would go past the clubhouse.
Okay, it says on the left-hand side from the clubhouse?
No, you go in straight through the entrance.
Oh, stuck in a rut. You need to listen.
And then you make a left.
Hold on, you need to listen.
Yeah. You go straight in. Don't turn and make a left. Shit, he's running.
He's running.
Shit,
which way
he's
is he running?
Down towards the other entrance of the neighborhood.
Okay, which entrance is that he's heading towards?
The back entrance.
Now listen, he just said fucking coons, okay?
Yeah. Okay,
he just said fucking coons, and I'll play it for you in a minute.
Alright, sir, what is your name?
George. He ran.
He ran. Oh, well, right, he's
George,
running away from you,
name?
You murdering bigot.
Zimmerman.
And George, what's the phone number you're calling from?
407-435-2400.
I haven't tried calling that
right,
number.
Sir,
I'm sure it's...
Do you want to meet with the officer when they get out
disconnected
there?
Disconnected by now.
Yeah.
All right, where are you going to meet with them at?
If they come in through the gate, tell them to go straight past the clubhouse. And straight past the clubhouse and make a left. And then they go past the mailboxes. You'll see my truck.
Okay, what address are you parked in front of?
I don't know. It's a cut through, so I don't know the address.
Okay, do you live in the area?
Yeah.
What's your apartment number?
It's a home. It's 1950. Oh, crap. I don't want to give it out loud. I don't know where
don't want to give his... He doesn't want
to
give his address?
With him right near the mailboxes, then?
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, George, I'll let him know to meet you with you out there, okay?
Actually, could you have him call me and I'll tell him where I'm at?
Okay, yeah, that's no problem.
You need my number or you got it?
Yeah, I got it. 407-435-2400.
Yeah, you got it.
Okay, no problem. I'll let them know to call you when they're in the area.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
And then they hang up. Okay. Now, during that call...
Seconds before...
Hold on. During that call, the cop said to George Zimmerman, are you following him? And he said, oh, yeah. And he said, we don't need you to do that. You know, they told him not to do that. The guy still got out of his car and chased the kid. You know why? Listen carefully. I pointed this out while the entire tape was playing. At 2 minutes and 22 seconds into that call, here we go. Did you hear that? I'll play it again. Let me boost the volume. Fucking coons is what he said. It's pretty clear. I didn't hear it until actually, oh God, what's his name? Turo? I don't even know who he is. Yeah, the guy, Turo? I don't know his name, but he pointed it out on Twitter, and I went in and listened, and it's clear as day.
I done been stopped shedding tears, now my eyes bleed when they cry. And I never understand why everybody gotta die. And everything that's born gotta go, and I really think that's a shame. And I'm so tired of reminiscing, trying to put a face to a name. You put my grandfather in my life, and then you took him away. Yeah, Big Daddy used to drink, but he gave me a place to stay. And many kids starving overseas, and even right here on my block. My auntie told me in the year 2000 that the world was gonna stop. Now I don't wanna question you, Lord, but it's violence really the answer? And if not, then how come so many innocent people dying of cancer? Now Revelation say the world gon' end, but the world ain't over yet. And it's up to us to move on, but in our hearts we never forget. Never forget the situation I was put on.
Leah, let's talk about this for a moment, because I am really struck by the behavior of this police department. Now, of course, we weren't there. It was a month ago. But you have a situation where... You mentioned this earlier before the break, that Trayvon Martin was sitting in the coroner's office and lying, I should say, dead in the coroner's office. He was admitted as a John Doe. Yet we now know that Trayvon Martin was on the phone, on the cell phone, literally seconds before. As he was accosted or allegedly accosted by Zimmerman. Why doesn't the police at this point, why don't they look at his phone, see that he had called a number literally minutes before and call to find out his identity? Why doesn't the police cross-reference what they know on the scene with what they know to be all the 9/11 calls that come in? I mean, I don't understand how they just let this guy walk away and didn't seem to do even the most cursory of investigations at that moment.
I know, that's inexplicable. I think even Barney Fife would have arrested this guy. I mean, it's so bad that they just cannot explain why they didn't do any. All they had to do was call the number that was on there. But instead, look at what they did. They drug tested this kid, Trayvon, to see if he had any drugs in him. They didn't even give that Zimmerman guy not a blood test, not an alcohol test to see if he was drunk. I don't understand how they could do that. And they're testing this poor kid.
I've heard reports... From witness a witness has said that she heard that when she was interviewed by the police at that time, she told them that she heard Trayvon Martin, without knowing his name, of course, screaming for help.
Right.
And we can hear this on the 911 call. We can actually hear him screaming for help in the background.
Right.
And the police said back to this witness, you heard George Zimmerman. And they said, no, I heard the kid. And they said, that's Zimmerman. And she said, okay, that's Zimmerman. She came out later and said, no, now I know who the different parties were. That was not Zimmerman that was screaming. It was the kid who was screaming. I mean, this seems to me, it's not even a question of their reaction to the investigation. There seems to be something incredibly corrupt about the investigation that took place. They didn't drug and test him, like you said, Zimmerman, who I think, and they let this guy walk away holding his gun.
Well, let me tell you what I think is the key to this. I think that there's a possibility that Zimmerman was an informer for the police. And being an informer, if he was, you know, I'm calling it from a long way away, but if he was an informer, he would be given that sort of protection. And I think they have to delve into that and find out. Because here's a guy that called 46 times And you know, when somebody calls like that, I mean, he's considered a quack at the police department. They probably wouldn't even listen to him, and they probably wouldn't listen to anything he said. So something's up here that's not coming out. And that's what we hope, the investigation by the governor and FDLE, and FDLE is a fine agency. I think they'll get to the bottom of it if they get on it.
Well, I hope you're right, and it's a good reason for the feds to come in, and the state as well, and I appreciate your time.
And in the news, wake up, nigga. The police shot another nigga today in the South Bronx. Wake up, nigga. And his only weapon was his wallet. Who gonna be next?
Wake up, wake up, wake up, wake
stay
up.
Stay tuned.
Backseat of the lap, big gat in my lap, ready for combat, feeling like Geronimo Pratt. We had the windows cracked, headed up to the strip, black rag in my hand, don't want no prints on the clip. Hollow tips, cause we thorough with this shit, my nigga. This ain't no game, we bang for you, who, my nigga? Now take a left with the light, turn off the headlights and ride real slow, and holla at me when you see the 5-0. Alright, dirty, y'all boys ready? We bout to turn drive-bys revolutionary. Yeah, motherfucker, yeah! Yeah, motherfucker, yeah. Look at them run, too scared to pull their guns. Out of shape from them coffees and them cinnamon buns. This shit is fun, how I feel when the tables is turned. Hollow tips hit your flesh through your vest and it burn. That's a lesson you learn, coming straight from the slums. And it don't stop till we get full freedom.
Yo, yeah, you need help, officer?
Die, die, die.
Yo, you got him?
Hell yeah, I got him.
Alright, that's what's
yeah,
up,
fuck them niggas. Let's ride to the north side, nigga. Dip out, dip out, dip out.
Just when you thought it was safe, police killed a little boy last night. They said it was a mistake, but that won't bring back his life. His mama couldn't believe that it could happen to her. She prayed to God every day. Guess it just wasn't enough.
And this is a revolutionary salute.
Hello, my name is Vladimir Dees, and this is a Class War Battlefield podcast. Quick comment. Let's get started. So when I heard about the Trayvon Martin case, I really didn't know what to say. I was discouraged. I wasn't angry. I was numb. I couldn't allow myself, I think, to get angry, because what would it be for? After having some time to think about it, in hearing a lot about it, after listening to Nicole Sandler talk about how Zimmerman probably called Trayvon a coon right before going after and shooting him, after listening to the Lawyers Guild show where it was suggested as a possibility that Zimmerman might be an informant. You know, the lawyer suggested that him calling 46 times and not being considered a nuisance suggests that there might have been a partnership between him and the police. After even having this interesting conversation with a man, one of my supervisors at work, who was just very incensed about it. It bothered him to no end. After all of this, and the Million Hoodie March, which I applaud the young people for it. I applaud everyone out there for it. After witnessing, you know, Al Sharpton again as the ambulance chaser that he is, a man that I have absolutely no respect for anymore. This man who's supposed to be a black leader, and yet, as you know, Malcolm X talked about, you know, they I forgot how he said it. He said, you know, these so-called Negro black leaders, they do something, but they never incite you. And that's Al Sharpton. But after all this, the only thing that keeps coming to my mind is, one, there's no justice for black people. There's just not. In America and the world, there's no justice for black people. Excusing good European ancestors that live today. White America, just, it doesn't, they don't care. They don't care. Black people are, we're expendable. You know, in history, it tells us this. I mean, in the 1940s, we were considered a racial problem. In the 1930s, we were considered a racial problem to be solved. Now, of course, somebody's going to write me an email and say, oh, well, this is what they meant. No, that's not what they meant. They didn't mean that they wanted to reconcile it, that they wanted to bring peace to it, or closure, that they wanted to bring integration to it. No, they wanted to subvert it. They wanted to suppress it. They wanted black people to remain in their same positions. We were a problem. We don't get justice. We just, Zimmerman's walking free. Oh, well, he's Hispanic. Yeah, so he's a good Negro then. Because that's the second thing that came to my mind. Is, well, Zimmerman isn't white. He's Hispanic, yes, so he's a good Negro then. That's great. What does that have to do with anything? If the tables were turned, and Trevon was the one who had shot him, people would have given glowing accounts of Zimmerman and just how much he loved his community and yada, yada, yada. And Trevon would be looking at 25 to life right now. At 17, he'd be looking at 25 to life. Zimmerman's looking at what? Civil rights violation? The man didn't violate his damn civil rights. He killed the man. We don't get justice. I mean, my God, man. The number of white folks that just murdered black people. You know, I've heard so many people talk about doing things within the system the last couple of days, and it boggles my mind. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? The system. Okay, let's talk about the system really quick. We have supposedly a black president sitting in the goddamn White House. Pardon my French. We have a president sitting in the White House who's supposed to be black. And there's a bill that's been stalled on the Senate floor to give something like $2 or $3 billion to farmers in the South that were discriminated against. We know they were discriminated against. And this president has said nothing about it. The system sucks. I said the other day in a separate entry that I do for like personal notes, when describing politics, because that's all this is now about to turn into just a theater of politics. Nobody gives a damn about Trevon except the people on the streets. The politicians are going to talk about doing what they can to quell the situation, to quiet the situation. The Justice Department, you know, under this House Negro, Eric Holder is now activating itself to go down and try to, you know, calm people's nerves as, you know, the FBI finally does something after 20 freaking days. What were they waiting for? Oh, there was an outcry, so they didn't give a damn. Politics. It is what the upper socioeconomic class does to implement a desire from the rest of society into the current structure, which enables them to actually stay in power and basically keep the status quo the same. That's what politics is. And I'm tired of that. What was it? A month ago, a little bit over a month ago, I can't remember the podcast I was listening to, but they were talking about the problem in with the New York PD. They are trigger happy when it comes to black and brown people. They had, last year they killed 43 unarmed black and brown people. You know, and they, look, to be fair, they, you gotta imagine they killed some poor white guys too. And we should include them, because that's as much as a travesty. Those white kids are dead, not because they were white, but because they were poor. So we need to start including them. They do matter. But my God, up until the middle of February, New York PD had already killed 21 people. 21. They had almost filled half of the quota that they had set the year before. And it wasn't even June. For black people, there's no justice. Zimmerman's going to go to jail. They're going to probably put him in solitary confinement so he's not killed. But in a year, who's going to remember Trayvon? In a year, who's going to care? These civil rights organizations, these universities that are mobilizing, all of these groups that are mobilizing, which, by the way, why is there no broad damn coalition across the country anymore to get these things underhand and to put some real pressure on these institutions? It saddens me. Because there's going to be way more. But who's going to stick up for them? And for that matter, Trayvon. People care about Trayvon because he was such angel face. His father lived in a gated community. So I'm going to tell you like this, people. If Trayvon was outside of those gates, and if he was killed by some stranger who had thought he was a burglar or what have you, nobody would care. Nobody would care. It's because he was in this gated community, which is supposed to be so diverse, you know, and accepting of all people. And I'm not saying they're not. I'm saying this is the reason why. I was listening to Black Talk Radio, and the gentleman made, you know, he made the claim, and it's partly right, that the reason why Trayvon is such a good poster child is because he was so clean-cut. But he missed one thing. There's clean-cut kids that get shot in the streets, but they're not in the gated community. A gated community that prides itself to be more liberal and progressive. You know, it has Hispanics, it has blacks, it probably has a few Asian people running around, you know. It was negative publicity. But nobody would care if he was outside those walls. People would march. It wouldn't be on the news. Would it be on Twitter? Hell yeah. But trust me when I tell you, they had to vet this kid before they put him on television. See, because if you put the wrong kid on television, then you open up a can of worms. If you put a kid on there that is from the streets, shot by the police, you start a national conversation about that. But this one kid, you really can't go that far with him because, hey, look at how clean cut he was. All these other kids over here, they're not so much clean cut, but hey, this one is. So you can't really connect this kid to that, to those kids, because this kid had a future. He had a bright future. He was about to go to college. This is the kind of kid that we want to live. These other kids over here, well, we're not giving up on them, but if they die, it's kind of a plus to society. Now, many of you are probably thinking, man, that's cynical. That's cynical. You think of it as cynical. You can think of it all you want like that, but it's realistic. We don't treat kids equally. We don't value them equally. We don't do it. We don't do it. And that's where the whole justice problem starts in the black community. Is our society doesn't value kids equally. If you live in a certain area, you have more value. If your parents live in a certain area, you have more value. Trevon is an igniting spark, but a spark to where?
Yeah.
A spark to where?
Come on.
I see no changes. Wake up in the morning and I ask myself, is life worth living? Should I blast myself? I'm tired of being poor and even worse, I'm black. My stomach hurts, so I'm looking for a purse to snatch. Cops give a damn about a Negro. Pull a trigger, kill a nigga, he's a hero. Get it back to the kids, who the hell cares? One less hungry mouth on the welfare. First ship him, don't let him deal with brothers. Give him guns, step back, watch them kill each other. It's time to fight back, that's what Huey said. Two shots in the dark, now Huey's dead. I got love for my brothers, but we can never go nowhere unless we share with each other. We gotta start making changes. Learn to see me as a brother instead of two distant strangers. And that's how it's supposed to be. I can the devil take a brother if he's close to me. I let it go back to when we played as kids, but then it changed. That's the way it is. Come on.
That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is. Oh yeah.
Hear me.
Come on. That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That's just the way it is. Oh yeah.
See no changes, all I see is racist faces. Misplaced hate makes disgrace to races. We under, I wonder what it takes to make this one better place, let's erase the wasted. Take the evil out the people, they'll be acting right. It's both black and white.
Well, welcome back. And the only time we the late great Tupac Shakur ends that large group of clips. The final one wasn't actually a clip, it was the aforementioned quick comment that I had put together. Originally, I was going to publish it separately, but I thought it was apt enough to fit into this collective group or this collective show. There was another clip that I discovered via another compilation podcast called Best of the Left Podcast. If you like liberal media, you absolutely would enjoy that. But it was from this show called Blacking Around or Blacking Out or something like that. I'm apologetic. I don't listen to the show. But there's this thing that one of the women said that was incredible. You know, I hadn't even thought about to do it in this large episode, but it is something that needs to happen. She said that she tells her brothers and she would have to tell her future sons, she's black, that they have to operate differently than their white counterparts. And then she questioned, of course, if indeed the white counterparts had to have that conversation with their children. And it's a great question. I know personally for me, there's a story that still tugs at me, I think, to this day. It doesn't make me angry. It doesn't even make me sad. but it changed my actions. For years I have lived in this small community, and I'm used to living in this small community. Everybody knows me because I live in a small community. Well, we had a chain store open, a Kenny's Drugs, and I didn't go in there for a while. And then one day I just decided I would go in there, and I started going in there pretty regularly. Well, a couple of years ago, I was still in college, around Thanksgiving, I went in to buy, I think it was deodorant of all things, and I was standing looking at the part, at the selection they had, and as a natural reaction, when I stand, I have to do something with my hands. So what do you think I did? I just put them in my pocket, didn't think about it. Suddenly, I heard, "Excuse me, sir? Sir?" I looked up, and there's this little woman coming towards me. "I need to see what you put in your pockets." I said, "Excuse me?" And she said, "Your pocket. I saw you put something in your pocket." And I said, "Yes, I put my hands in my pockets." She said, "I need you to go up to the counter and empty out your pockets." And I said, "Oh, I put my hands in my pocket." And she insisted, so we went up there. And I emptied out my pockets, and the only thing I had in there were my gloves. And some used tissues, and I think my wallet at the time. And her face turned white as a ghost. And she apologized profusely, offered to bring out her manager. I told her it was no big deal, just don't do it again, you know. And I saw her a couple of days later, and I smiled at her, and, you know, I hold no ill will towards her for it. And she explained to me that her husband worked downstate. I live in upstate New York, in western New York, and he works downstate at a juvenile detention center. And the majority of the people who are in that detention center are black and brown. Her husband is white. So she was able to piece together that because of those kids that he worked with, she had developed a natural discriminating view of certain motions committed by certain groups of people, particularly black and brown. What it did to me, and in further kind of thinking about it, it changed how I operated when I was in stores. I became conscious of everything. Whether or not I had my bag with me, because I usually carry a bag with me whenever I go into a store, whether it's an over-the-shoulder bag or it's a regular cloth bag. If I have my bags with me, I have to set them up front. Where are my hands at all times? Do I have things around me, or am I holding things that somebody might see as potential items for which I can steal? And it wasn't until a couple of years that I realized that that one act made me conscious of my blackness. A lot of white folks don't get it. They don't understand. As black people, we have to act differently. There is this stigma with us. Unless we are wearing a three-piece suit with shiny shoes, cut to the hilt, driving a beautiful car, there's a stigma. Now, the stigma, if you're an older black person, you know, you're seen more as a nurturing type, probably more like a my mind's drawing a blank at this moment of actors, Morgan Freeman type of person, you know, maybe even a Florida Evans type of person. But if you're young, if you're in your 30s, your 20s, your teens, you're looking to cause trouble. You're looking to take something that's not yours. You're looking to vandalize something because you're just angry. Of course, people don't like to talk about why you're angry or if you have a correct reason to be angry. It just is something that is. And we know that. We as black people, we learn it at a very, very young age. How we should look, how we should approach people, how we should talk to people, how our actions can have or can cause negative reactions. We learn this. Brown people do too. See, one of the biggest misconceptions that I continuously hear is that the newer generation is less racist, that the newer generation will have no conception of what racism is. And I laugh at that, because everywhere around us is items of racism and discrimination. I must admit, I continue to use the term racism in so many wrong ways. I use it in place of discrimination, in place of bigotry, or bigoted, or various other words, prejudice, for instance. But I use it in those terms because everybody else uses it in those terms. I'm not going to get into that discussion right now. I'll have to post on Radio for All the episode 4 and its addendums all put together. But this whole notion that the newer generation, just by waving a magic wand, they're going to be less racist, really doesn't do justice to the culture that we are growing up in. The culture that we're growing up in is highly prejudicial, highly bigoted, highly slanted towards propping up the white ego structure. And I don't say that lightly. I don't say it in a way of, you know, hoping to tear people down. But it's the truth. Black people have been relegated in this corporate culture to buffoons. We are either afterthoughts, meaning there's one of us on the TV screen just to make it appear like it's diverse. You know, there's a weird underling to that which kind of says the person's only there because of affirmative action. Or we're entertainers of some sort. We are not acknowledged for our brains. And don't bring me these conservative blanks who don't even identify themselves really as black, outside of being able to say, well, look, I'm a black conservative, so more black people should be black conservatives. No. They don't identify anything with their blackness. I've had this conversation with you already, so I'm not going to go into it. But we've really been relegated to the margins of culture. And we are raising an entire generation on this concept. For instance, many white folks I have talked to, maybe this is just something in my town, and other people haven't experienced this, but I've talked to white kids about rap music and was amazed to have these white kids attempt to tell me, a black man, about rap. And try to, quote, correct me. I use quotes because that's what they were trying to do, even though they weren't doing it. They were trying to correct me on the reality of my culture. And the first couple of times that happened, I was so shocked. I didn't know how to respond to it. Now I realize that it's the whole white privilege thing. You've always been right, so to find somebody who tells you, no, you're not right, particularly somebody who has usually been wrong, I mean, throughout our history, black people have usually been right on conscious issues, but we have always been told that we were wrong. So to have that kind of confront you, that's a little devastating, and I can understand that. I'm going to shift now, though, and this is kind of a rough shift, so I apologize. But I want to talk about George Zimmerman. Before I go, there's a couple of things that I want to say about this brother. First and foremost, he is a brother. I know people are going to get angry at me for saying that, but you can't take away the fact that this man is human, that he has feelings, that he has thoughts, you know, that he has a family. We live in an eye for an eye society, where if somebody does something to you, then it's expected that you get justice for that. And justice usually comes in the form of, you know, them getting done to them something equal or worse than what you had done to you. So, when I heard that George Zimmerman was receiving death threats, over 500 of them, apparently, well, as of last week, Lord only knows what it's up to now, it didn't surprise me. But what did surprise me was that there was not many more people saying, we must not forget George Zimmerman is a human too. And as a human, he makes mistakes. Yes, a young man is dead. But let's not compound the problem by crucifying this man just because we are that angry where we want a scapegoat. Now, I'm angry at what's going on, but here's the reality. George Zimmerman is only one piece of a larger puzzle. You know, I've heard, after listening to the Best of the Left podcast on this issue, it was for this week, you know, I almost am enraged at the way that the liberals and progressives on this podcast picked this story up and ran with it. Particularly when, what is it, Cenk Uygur, who made a statement to the effect that his show called the FBI and said, hey, you know, this might be, you know, this whole thing with John Martin might be something you want to get involved in. And then, you know, he suggested, rather passively, that it might have been this call that pushed them over the edge, you know, to kind of get involved in things. And that in and of itself, to me, is just pure egotistical arrogance, but whatever. I've heard it before. And I'm not mad at, you know, Mr. Uygur, nor am I trying to tear him down. I'm just definitely making an observation that I guarantee I'm not the only one who would have made it. But, no, overall, I'm a little bit dismayed because, as I said in my quick comment, who's going to care about Trevon in a year? Hell, nobody's even talking about the connection between Trevon and Troy Davis. I have this old quick comment that I did, which I'm not going to play it. I didn't like it then, and I don't like it now, from Troy Davis. And I made a statement similar to the statement that I made in my earlier quick comment. It wasn't that black people get no justice. It was that there's a group of people who just don't care about people like Troy Davis. He serves as a warning, or he served as a warning, to a group of individuals who might want to get in enough trouble where they'd have to go to jail. You get in too much trouble, this warning said, and you can end up on death row. And, hey, Troy Davis isn't even guilty, and he's dead now. It could be you, too. I know it's far-fetched, but it is what I said. And it's almost like Trevon Martin serves that same purpose. Don't get beside yourself, nigga. Because you really don't matter. Yes, you have a, quote, black president. But ultimately, the justice system still works for us. Now, I heard a great, great question the other day about Mr. Zimmerman and his coon remark. What organization does he belong to where he might hear such a thing? Or might express such a thing and might not be ridiculed for it. Kind of makes you think, where did he get that from? Why did he say it? See, I'm displeased at Mr. Zimmerman. I don't like what he did. Agape love, which is something that I work hard to practice, dictates that I can't be angry at him or not love him for what he's done. I hate the deed, but I love the sinner or the deed executor. But I can question his motives. I can question what led to that. And way at the beginning of the show, the Martin Luther King clip that I played, remember what he asked. Remember what he said about investigating the society that made the mindset possible. Nobody seems to want to make that a priority. Nobody wants to discuss what in our society could make something like that happen. It's like everyone's afraid to touch that. Well, I guess everyone's also afraid to say that Zimmerman is a human too. But he is. That's two things that we can never lose sight of. Throughout all this, remember, Zimmerman is still a human. What was going through his mind, you know? That's the other thing we have to remember. Answer those questions. What was going through his mind? Everyone keeps saying, oh, well, you know, and hatred was going through his mind. He was just a racist and blah, blah, blah. You know, something that's so easy. It's so easy. Take a step back. Think about the last big mistake you made. What was going through your mind? And then think about, then detach yourself from that. And think about if you were observing yourself, and what would you imagine was going through your mind when you did that, and then compare the two. It's hard to do, but man, with practice you learn to do it, and man, does it change your view of other people. Because what you realize is, what your motives were at the time would be different than what the random observer would believe your motives were. And Zimmerman's the same way. I'm not saying don't be angry. I'm not saying, you know, don't protest anything like that. What I am saying is just remember, keep your eyes open. Zimmerman is still a human. Now, maybe this time if we find out what causes it, maybe we can eradicate it. Maybe that's wishful thinking. I want to thank you all for listening. This is episode number 2. I'm still waiting. I'd love to have your 1 to 2 minute audio comments and stories. Like I said, you can send them to classwarbattlefieldpodcast@live.com. High quality. If you need to put it in a lower grade, just note that to me, and I'll do what I can to spiff it up when I publish it. My name is Brian Meridice, and I hope you have a great, great week. I'll see you next time.